prepared for the long drop. Anna hit the ground almost immediately with a sudden spine-cracking thump. Ow! Shit! Joe? Chris's voice called down. Are you okay? I attempted to sit up. My back hurt a bit. It felt bruised, but it could have been worse. A lot worse. I looked up. I could see torchlights and vague silhouettes, only a few feet above me. We had found it, I realized. We were here. I pushed myself to my feet. My ankle twinged again. Shit. I clutched at it. It already felt a bit swollen. I hoped I'd just twisted it and not broken anything. I still had to climb back up those friggin' steps. I'm okay, I shouted back up. But I've hurt my fucking ankle. Boo-hoo. What can you see? What's down there? Hurst's voice, as caring and compassionate as ever. My helmet had been knocked sideways. I propped myself against one rocky wall, relieving the weight on my bad ankle and adjusted it. I looked around. More wooden beams were set into the walls. They ran straight up from the ground. Between them I could see other shapes and patterns. They looked like they had been made by white sticks embedded into the rock. They formed intricate designs, stars and eyes, odd-looking letters, stick men. I fought back a small shiver. On some of the walls there were fewer patterns. Instead, piles of sticks and yellow rocks were stacked tightly into large, arched alcoves. I didn't like it. Any of it. It was creepy. Weird. Wrong. I heard the others descending. Chris stepped slowly down into the cavern. Hurst jumped and landed beside me with a thud, almost immediately followed by Marie and Fletch. There was a pause as they all looked around, taking it in. Whoa, this is well cool, Marie said. It's like something out of the Lost Boys.
Is it somewhat to do with the pit? Fletch asked, displaying his usual abundance of imagination.
No.
The word came from Chris, but he snatched it from the tip of my tongue.
This wasn't something forged by miners. Mines were hacked, punched and hewn from the rock. It was clumsy and rough and industrial, done with heavy tools and machinery. This was something different. It had not been formed by necessity or stoic workmanship. It had been created by, I sort of wanted to say, passion. But that wasn't quite right either. As I gazed around, another word thrust itself into my head. Devotion. That was it. Devotion.
Shine your torch round, fuckwit, Hurst said to Fletch, who duly obliged.
He turned in a circle, pointing the torch around the cavern. It only just reached the far walls, and rather than illuminating it, it seemed to accentuate the deep hollows and corners filled with blackness. It was probably just some weird effect of the light, but if you glanced quickly, out of the corner of your eye, it almost looked like the shadows were moving, shifting and ebbing restlessly.
This is well weird, Hurst muttered.
Doughboy's right. This ain't no mine. He turned to me.
What do you think, Thorny?
I was trying, but thinking was hard down here. Even though the cavern was big and far less stifling than the narrow tunnel, I was still finding it laborsome to breathe, like the air was wrong. Like the oxygen had been replaced with something else, something heavier and sort of foul. Something no one should breathe, ever.
Poisonous gases. I thought suddenly. My dad had often spoken about the fumes released from deep down in the earth. Was that it? Were we slowly being poisoned while we stood here? I glanced over at Chris.
Chris, what is this place?
He still stood near the steps, venturing no further. His face in the grimy gloom was pale, streaked with dirt, not scared exactly, but tense. He looked much older than his 15 years, like the man he would never become. Then his vivid eyes met mine, and I understood. He hadn't found this place. It had found him. And now he desperately wanted it to let him go again.
"Don't you know yet?" he said. "Don't you get it?"
I looked back around the cavern, at the high vaulted roof, the wooden beams. And that was when something in my head clicked. Because when you looked again, it was obvious. Air that shouldn't be breathed. A huge underground chamber. Like a church, but not.
"Get what?"
Hurst asked. And right on the heels of that thought came another. The white sticks in the walls and the rocks piled in the alcoves. I limped forward, towards the nearest wall. The light on my helmet illuminated a star, a symbol like a hand and a stick figure. Up close they weren't pure white, and they weren't sticks. There was something else. Something you would expect to find in a place like this. In a grave. A burial chamber.
"Thorny, are you going to tell me what the fuck is going on?"
Hurst snarled dangerously.
"Bones,"
I whispered, horror leeching the strength from my voice.
"The rock. It's full of bones."
23. Sometimes it takes a while for you to realize that something is wrong. Something is off. It stinks. Like when you stand in dog shit, and it's not until you're sitting in the car, wondering where the bad smell is coming from, that it sinks in. The stink is coming from you. You brought it along for the ride. When I get back to the cottage, I notice that the front door is ajar, just a little. I'm sure I remember closing and locking it. As I get closer, I see that the frame is splintered and cracked. Someone has forced it. I push the door all the way open and walk inside. The cushions on the sofa have been thrown off and sliced open, spilling their foamy guts all over the floor. The coffee table has been tipped up, the drawers from the small cabinet yanked out. My laptop is in pieces. The cottage has been ransacked. I frown, my mind taking a while to assess the situation. And then it dawns on me. Fletch and his sons, probably on instructions from Hurst. I guess he didn't want to negotiate after all. Typical Hurst. If someone won't give you something, you take it, by any means. Except I know damn well they won't have found what they were looking for. I walk wearily upstairs. My mattress has been slashed and eviscerated. The clothes in the wardrobe pulled off hangers and dumped in a heap on the floor. I bend down to pick up some shirts and I can immediately tell from the dampness and acrid smell that they have been liberally pissed upon. I check in the bathroom. Shower curtain yanked down for no apparent reason. The top taken off the cistern and smashed. I could have told them that nothing they could do in here could disturb me more than the things I've already encountered. Finally, I check the spare room. Ben's room. I open the door. I stare at the lacerated mattress, the ripped-up carpet, and feel a slow burn of anger. I limp back downstairs. I find Abby eyes in the log burner, along with the folder that I discovered beneath the angel. I crouch down and take them both out. They're dusty and black, but they haven't been set alight. I wonder why.
I place Abby eyes on the coffee table. After a moment's consideration, I slip the folder inside one of the slit-open cushions, just to be on the safe side. Something is bothering me. Why didn't Fletcher's lads burn them? Have they got bored of their destruction by this point? Seems unlikely. Did they run out of time? Or was it something else? Were they disturbed? Interrupted? I suddenly have a very bad feeling. There's a creak from the kitchen. I straighten and turn. Evening, Joe. I sit on the cushion of sofa. Gloria perches delicately on the armchair. Flames crackle noisily in the log burner. This is not as homely as it sounds. Gloria wears black leather gloves and holds a poker in one hand. What are you doing here? Checking up on your welfare? I find that hard to believe. She laughs. My bladder cramps. I saw you had some visitors today. You met them? They were leaving just as I arrived. We didn't have a chance to chat. She glances around. It strikes me that they were searching for something. Perhaps the same thing that you were hoping your old friend might stump up a wad of cash for. They didn't find what they were looking for. You're sure? Yes. Why? Because I don't have what they're looking for. Not here. She considers this. I have found in my line of work that it is beneficial to be in possession of all the facts. I've told you. You've told me. Fuck all. She slams the poker down on the coffee table. Abby Eyes flies into the air and lands near my feet. A crack splits her plastic features. Her loose eye spills out of the socket. It stares up at me from the floor. Sweat gathers at the base of my spine. Fortunately, Gloria continues, I've done a little research of my own. It was interesting. She stands, walks over to the log burner, bends down and opens it. Let me take you back 25 years. 5 school friends. You, Stephen Hurst, Christopher Manning, Marie Gibson and Nick Fletcher. Oh, and your little sister Annie. Never told me about her. She sticks the end of the poker into the burner, wedging it deep inside the logs. The flames crackle louder. One night, when you were out with your friends, she went missing. Disappeared from her own bed. There were searches, appeals. Everyone thought the worst. And then, miraculously, after 48 hours, she came back. But she couldn't, or wouldn't, say what had happened to her. I don't see. Let me finish. Happy ending. Except, 2 months later, Daddy crashes his car into a tree, killing little Annie and himself, and leaving you critically injured. How am I doing so far? I stare at the poker, in the fire. Out of the frying pan, I think wildly. Like you said, you've done your research, I say. Gloria begins to pace. Oh, I left a bit out. A few weeks after your sister's return, your friend, Christopher Manning, falls from the school English block. Tragic coincidence, don't you think?
Life is full of tragic coincidences.
Fast forward to now, and you return to the village where you grew up. You plan to blackmail your old school friend, Stephen Hurst, for a large amount of cash. What do you have on him? What is he hiding?
Someone like Hurst has plenty of secrets.
I'm beginning to think you do too, Joe.
Why do you care?
Because I like you.
You have a very odd way of showing it.
Put it another way, then. You interest me.
Not many people do.
For a start, you're one of the least likely teachers I've ever met. You're a drunk, a gambler, but you have a vocation. You choose to impart knowledge to children. Why is that?
You get a lot of holidays.
I think it's because of what happened here 25 years ago. I think you're trying to make amends for something.
Or just trying to make a living?
Flippancy is a flimsy defense mechanism. Trust me, I should know. It's one of the first things to fall away when people are in fear for their lives.
Is that a threat?
You wish. Actually, what I'm giving you is a lifeline.
She walks over. I flinch. She bends down and holds something out. A card. Blank except for a phone number. She reaches down and slips it into the pocket of my jeans, patting me gently on the crotch.
You can reach me on this for the next 24 hours if you need my help.
Why?
Because deep down, I have a soft spot for you.
That's comforting to hear.
Don't take it to heart.
My eyes flick back to the poker. The fire spits.
The fat man is getting impatient.
I told you,
shut up!
The sweat is now trickling down between my ass cheeks. My stomach is a tight ball of cramp. I want to be sick, to shit, and to piss all at once.
He gave you extra time. Now he wants his money.
He'll get it. That's why I'm here.
I know, Joe. And if it were just up to me...
She gives a dainty shrug.
But it looks to him like you ran. That doesn't inspire faith. The fat man wants to be sure you understand how serious he is.
I do. Really.
She takes the poker out of the log burner. The tip glows red. I glance towards the door, but I know I'd be in a headlock before my backside left the armchair.
Please.
Like I said, Joe, I have a soft spot for you.
She walks over and crouches down next to me. She holds up the poker. I can feel the heat. Gloria smiles.
So, I'm going to spare your pretty face.
I lie on the sofa. I have taken 4 codeine tablets and finished the bottle of bourbon. My left hand is bound in an old tea towel and resting on a pack of frozen fish fingers. It is now only mildly agonizing. I'm not expecting to be playing a violin concerto anytime soon. My skin feels hot and feverish. I drift in and out of consciousness. Not sleep, just an illusory grey and black place peppered with strange visions. In one, I'm back at the old colliery site. I'm not alone. Chris and Annie stand on the crest of a hill. The sky hangs above them like a bag of mercury, swollen with silvery light and fluid with black rain. The wind rages and tears with invisible claws. Chris's head is oddly misshapen, caved in at the back. Blood runs from his nose and eyes. Annie holds his hand. And this Annie, I know, is my Annie. The ugly gash is there on her head, deep and ruinous. As I watch, she opens her mouth and says softly,
I know where the snowmen go, Joe. I know where they go now.
She smiles, and I feel happy, calm, at peace. But then the clouds above them lower and swell, and instead of rain, a cascade of shiny black beetles pours down. I watch my friend and my sister fall to the ground engulfed in the scuttling mass of bodies, until all I can see is a swarm of blackness, devouring them, swallowing them whole. My phone starts to ring. Saved by the Bell. Or rather Metallica. I roll over and pick it up with my good hand. I squint at the screen. Brendan. I press accept with a shaky finger. You're alive, I croak. Last time I checked. You sound like shit. Thanks. You love my honesty. Don't forget your pert ass. Healthy eating, no booze. You should try it. I've been calling you for days, I say. Lost my phone charger. What's so urgent? I just wanted to check you were okay. Aside from missing my favourite pub, Dandy, when can I go back? I look at my bandaged, burnt hand. Not yet. Feck. It might be an idea to move out of the flat for a while as well.
Jesus, is this to do with your habit of owing money to unpleasant people?
Guilt stabs my insides. Brendan has been good to me, more than good. He's let me share his flat rent-free. He has never lectured me on my gambling. Most people would have given up on me, but not Brendan. And now I'm paying him back by putting him in danger.
Have you got somewhere to stay tonight?
Tonight?
Well, there's my sister. I'm sure her husband will be bloody delighted about that.
It shouldn't be for long.
I should fucking hope not. He sighs. You know what my dear old mammy would say?
I'm losing my voice, hopefully.
When does a hare stop running from the fox? I groan.
When?
When it hears the hunter's bugle.
Meaning?
Sometimes you need someone bigger, like the police, to sort out your problem.
I am sorting it, okay?
Like you sorted it before, stealing money from the school safe.
I never took a penny.
True, but only because Debbie, the secretary with the handbag addiction, got there before me. When I found this out, we came to an agreement. I would say nothing if she paid the money back. I would also leave quietly. I was on my final written warning for timekeeping, sloppy work and general shittiness of attitude by that point anyway. Oh, and she would owe me.
That was different.
I remember. I was the one who brought you grapes every day in hospital when you couldn't pay your debts and someone made papier-mâché out of your knee.
You visited me twice in hospital and you never brought me grapes.
I sent you texts.
You sent me porn.
Well, who needs feckin' grapes?
Look, I really will sort this.
Did I mention that I'll have to share my sister's spare room with feckin' hamsters that squeak their wheels all night?
I'm sorry.
Or that she has two young kids who think 5 o'clock in the morning is a perfectly acceptable time to play trampoline on their uncle's stomach.
I'm sorry.
Sorry will not help my hernia.
I just need a few more days.
A deep, deep sigh. Fine. But if you don't sort it, or if you run into anything you can't handle,
I'll call you.
Jesus, no. Call the police, you moron. Or the A-team.
24.
So then I said to this pupil that while I respected her right to express herself by throwing the shoe,
Simon is drawling on.
It says something about my current state of mind that the soporific nature of his voice is vaguely bearable this lunchtime. Or perhaps I've just managed to tune him out to white noise. Irritating, but ignorable. It's just me, Simon and Beth at lunch today. I am not hungry. Not in the slightest. But I forced down some chips in the vague hope they might help my hangover. I also have my second can of full-fat Coke in front of me. Simon has gone through the obligatory and predictable drinking on a school night jokes. I smile politely and just about manage not to punch him in the face. It would hurt my hand, for one thing. I have made a relatively professional-looking bandage out of a cut-up pillowcase and told people that I burnt myself on the oven. Drunken cooking, etc. Beth occasionally gives me knowing looks. She doesn't believe me. I don't care. Right now, I am more preoccupied by last night. By what Marcus told me. By my encounter with Gloria. By what a mess I'm in, and how it would be difficult for things to get any worse.
Mr. Thorne?
I look up. Harry is standing by the dining table. His face is grim.
Could we have a word in my office?
Difficult, but not impossible.
Of course.
I wait for some sort of snide comment from Simon. None is forthcoming. He seems intent upon his lunch. Too intent. I scrape back my chair. Beth raises her eyebrows. Catch you later?
Yeah.
I follow Harry along the corridor. Can I ask what this is about?
I'd rather wait until we reach my office.
His tone is hard, non-committal. I don't like it. I have a very bad feeling about this. Which, considering my starting point this morning, is impressive. Harry pushes open the door and steps inside. I follow him. And stop. Dead. A visitor sits in front of Harry's desk. As we enter, he stands and turns. I'd say my heart sinks, but I'm not sure it could dive much further without a mask and oxygen. In fact, I almost laugh. Really, I should have expected it. I'm a gambler. You're supposed to think about all possible outcomes. Before you act, work out your strategy. But I suddenly feel as though I've been flapping about, like a tasty bit of tuna at a table of sharks. Harry closes the door and looks between the pair of us.
I believe you two know each other.
We both grew up in Arnhill, Stevenhurst says. Other than that, I wouldn't say I really know Mr. Thorne at all.
Well, I was picky about my friends even then, I say.
Hurst's smug expression falters momentarily. Then he spots my bandaged hand. Been picking fights again?
Only with the oven.
But if you're offering.
Mr. Thorne, Mr. Hurst, Harry interrupts curtly, can we all sit down?
Hurst lowers himself into his seat. I walk over and reluctantly do the same. It feels a lot like how we used to sit in front of the headmaster 25 years ago.
So, Harry says, and shuffles some papers in front of him. Some things have come to my attention that I think we need to discuss.
I try to adopt a pleasant tone.
Is this regarding Jeremy Hurst and the incident with Marcus Dawson in the toilets yesterday? Because,
no, Harry cuts me dead, it's not about that.
Oh.
I'm back-footed. I glance at Hurst. His face has resumed its former self-satisfied expression. I would like to smash it from his jowls. I would like to leap from my chair, grab him around the throat and choke him until his eyes bulge and his tongue turns blue. Instead, I say,
then I suppose you had better enlighten me.
Prior to taking the position with us here at Arnhill, you worked at Stockford Academy.
That's right.
You supplied a reference from your former head, Miss Coombs? I can feel sweat starting to dampen my underarms.
Yes.
Except that's not entirely true, is it?
I'm afraid I don't understand.
Miss Coombs did not supply that reference.
She didn't.
She denies any knowledge of it.
Well, I think there may have been some miscommunication.
I doubt it. Miss Coombs was quite clear. You left Stockford Academy suddenly, not long after a substantial amount of money went missing from the school safe.
That money was recovered.
Hurst can't contain himself any longer.
Apparently you like to play cards, Joe.
I turn.
Why? Fancy a game of liar?
And what exactly does any of this have to do with you?
In case you've forgotten, I'm on the board of governors. When it is brought to my attention that one of the teachers here is not fit for the job,
Sorry. Brought to your attention. By whom?
His lips purse. And then it comes to me.
Simon Saunders.
He was in the Fox the night I ran into Hurst.
He knows him.
Doesn't everyone in Arnhill? Why go running to Harry, when he could go over his head and tell all to someone on the Board of Governors? Someone who already hates my guts. Get Hurst on side and maybe store up some favours for himself. Two birds, one poisonous little toad.
You should be careful who you listen to, I say.
You're not denying it, then?
I would say that the version presented here bears only a vague resemblance to the truth, something which I would prefer to discuss with my superior, in private.
Hurst's eyes flash. The truth is that you accepted this position under false pretenses, and you left your previous position under a cloud. This, on top of the fact that you have some vendetta against my son, no doubt based upon your imagined prior history with me. Your demeanour and performance as a teacher are entirely unsuitable. Oh, and you stink of booze.
He straightens his tie and sits back triumphantly.
Harry stares at me, wearily, from across the desk.
I'm sorry, Mr. Thorne. This will go before the board. You are entitled to union representation, but in the light of these revelations.
Accusations. Unproven in the most part.
Still, I have no choice but to temporarily suspend you from teaching duties while we come to a decision about your future with the Academy.
I understand. I stand, trying to contain the trembling in my body. Partly the hangover, mostly anger. I mustn't let it show. Mustn't let Hurst know he's got to me. Always keep the game face on.
I'll just collect my things.
I walk towards the door and stop. You also need to let them know that you still hold the winning card. I glance at Hurst.
Nice tie, by the way.
The look on his face is all I need. I don't return to the canteen. I gather my coat and satchel from the staff room, which is mercifully empty, and head out of the school. I don't trust myself to face Simon again, even though I'm already under suspension. An assault charge isn't something I particularly want to add to my CV. When I reach reception, I pause. Miss Grayson is not in her usual place in her small glass cubicle. Instead, a younger clone, short dark hair, glasses, although no hairy mole, is sitting in her seat, tapping at a computer.
Excuse me, where's Miss Grayson?
She has a cold.
Oh.
Did you need to speak with her?
Well, I'm leaving and was hoping to say goodbye. Do you know when she'll be back?
I'm afraid not.
Right. Thanks for your help.
I start to turn.
Oh, Mr. Thorne.
Yes?
Mr. Price requested you hand in your front door pass when you leave.
My pass? The pass that allows me to enter the school? Harry really isn't taking any chances.
Worried I might sneak back in and steal the school lunch money.
She doesn't smile. I wonder how much she knows. How much they all know.
Fine.
I take it out of my pocket and just about manage not to slam it on her desk.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And pass on my regards to Miss Grayson.
Of course.
She offers an efficient smile. Then she picks up the pass and, as if I was in any doubt about my suspension being temporary, produces a pair of scissors, cuts it neatly in half, and drops it in the bin. The cottage eyes me resentfully upon my return. Its one good window glowering darkly.
Look!
It seems to hiss from between the splintered wood of the front door.
Look what you have done. Are you happy yet?
No, I think. Because I am not done yet. I push at the door. It sticks. And then gives with a reluctant groan.
I'm not entirely sure the cottage is on my side in all of this. It is too much in cahoots with the past. Too much a part of the village. It does not want me here. It has no intention of making me comfortable. But that's fine, too. I don't plan to be here for very much longer. I walk inside and throw my bag on the sofa. The room is still in much the same state as when I returned last night. Internal injuries. I consider tidying up and sorting out some of the mess. Then I go and smoke a cigarette. Perhaps Hurst has done me a favour, speeding up the inevitable. After all, I never intended to stay, did I? I never intended to settle back down in a place that holds such dark and painful memories. The wounded animal doesn't escape the trap, only to throw itself back into the metal jaws and wait for them to pulverize its bones. Not unless it has a damn good reason. I'd like to say the reason was Annie, or the message. But it's not that simple. Even all that guilt and recrimination weren't enough to drag me back here. Not on their own. The truth is, I was desperate. I needed to get away, and I saw an opportunity to settle bad debts and old scores at the same time. Perhaps it had always been at the back of my mind. I knew I had something that could screw up Hurst's life. The idea he might pay money for it came later. I hadn't expected him to be quite so determined to hound me out of the village. But despite all his threats and manipulations, ultimately, Hurst has played his hand. He doesn't have anything left. There is only one way to get rid of me now, and although I've no doubt that Hurst is capable of murder, the stakes are higher. Is he willing to risk his career, his comfortable life, his family? I'm hoping the answer is no, but on the other hand, I wouldn't bet on it. I close the back door and walk inside. The feeling of coldness is on me again. I can hear the walls chittering. I am starting to become used to both the cold and the incessant tinnitus of the cottage. I'm not sure whether, like tuning out Simon's monotonous drone, this is a good thing. Once you become accustomed, you become complacent, and then you become either complicit or consumed. I wander back through to the living room and take out my phone. I pull up Brendan's number. He answers on the second ring. What do you want now? Isn't it enough to hear the dulcet tones of your voice? You'd better be wearing underwear. I need a favour. Seriously? You know, right now, I have gerbil shit in my beard. I thought it was hamsters. Gerbils, hamsters, who gives a feck? The little bastard spent all last night kicking crap onto my head. How long do I have to stay here? Do you still have that holdall I asked you to look after?
Holdall? What holdall?
Sides literally splitting.
Yes, I've got it.
Can you courier it to me overnight?
Joe, look, I just want to say, you've been a good friend. Thank you.
Don't go all mushy on me. Well, I thought I'd say it in case I actually do. There's a pause and then Brendan says with heartfelt emotion,
just feck off before I end up doing an Ozzy Osbourne on one of these feckin' gerbils.
He ends the call. I glance at my watch. It's 3:30 p.m. I stare around the wrecked living room. I pick up Abby Eyes from the floor and place her back on the armchair. She observes me with one cold blue eye. The hollow socket yawns darkly. I look around but can't see her other eye anywhere. I have a sudden mental image of it being carried away on the backs of scuttling beetles. I thank my imagination. I really needed that. My phone starts to ring, making me jump. I press accept.
Were you going to mention playing hooky? I might have joined you.
Of course. How did you get my number?
From Danielle on reception.
I know her brother. He's in my pub quiz team.
So I suppose you know what happened.
Harry told me that you were taking a leave of absence.
That's what he called it.
What would you call it?
I hesitate.
You're leaving, aren't you?
I think I might have already left.
Jesus, that's got to be a world record.
I'm glad my brevity impresses you.
Don't tell everyone. Is this about yesterday with Jeremy Hurst?
No.
Then what?
It's a little complicated.
How complicated?
Well,
a few pints complicated or several glasses of bourbon complicated?
I consider. Definitely the latter.
Right. I'll see you in the Fox at 7. Line your stomach first.
She ends the call without saying goodbye.
Why do people keep doing that?
I should have said something. I have questions. But I suppose they can wait. I sit down heavily on the hard sofa frame and think about making a coffee. Then I glance at Abby Eyes. Or maybe that should be Abby Eye. I shake off a shudder. Decision made. I head back out the door and walk down to the chippy. 25. The Fox looks even more run down and dilapidated tonight. It's decaying, I think. As if my presence here has started some sort of chain reaction. As if this small, shriveled place has been held in some mummified state, and now a crack has appeared, a little bit of oxygen admitted into the rarefied environment, and suddenly everything is rotting from within. I push open the doors and walk inside. A quick appraisal informs me that Hurst is not here, and nor are any of his goons. A few elderly patrons, probably the same ones from the other night, vegetate at tables, staring into their pints of ale and lager tops. Beth isn't here yet, but I spot one familiar face. Lauren is back behind the bar, which, while not exactly evoking rainbows, sunshine and tweeting birds, is at least better than Nosferatu's surly countenance. I smile. All right. She stares at me as though she's never seen me before in her life. Joel Thorne? Teacher? We bumped into each other up at the old colliery site.
Oh, yeah, right.
Her face moves a little. Could be a smile. Could be a twitch of annoyance, hard to tell.
So, what can I get you?
Bourbon, please, double.
Make that two.
I turn. Beth stands at my side. Her hair is loose for once and falls around her shoulders in semi-dreadlocks. An oversized leather jacket swamps her small frame and makes her legs in sprayed-on black jeans and DMs look even skinnier. A nose ring glints as she grins at me.
You are the talk of the staff room, Mr. Thorne.
Really? Might explain why my ears are burning.
Yeah, well, that might also be the effigy Simon has of you that he's sticking pins into.
I imagine he's overcome by sorrow at my premature departure.
If singing Oh, What a Beautiful Morning is evidence of his sorrow, then yes.
Lauren plonks both glasses down upon the bar. The delivery is abrupt, but just by glancing at them, I can tell she has been generous with the measures.
£9, please.
Thanks. I pay with my last 20, wondering how far over my overdraft I currently am, and how long before the bank stops all my cards. Beth picks up a glass.
Shall we?
We walk towards a table in a far corner. One thing the Fox does have going for it is plenty of dim, dusty corners in which to lurk if you would rather not be seen or overheard. Beth sits herself down on one of the hard wooden chairs and I follow suit. We both take sips of our drinks, mine a bit larger than hers.
So, she says meaningfully, want to tell me what really happened?
What's Harry said?
You have taken a leave of absence for personal reasons.
What does the grapevine say?
Oh, you've had some kind of breakdown. Hurst Sr. got you sacked. You've been abducted by aliens, that type of thing.
Right.
So which is it?
Aliens, naturally. They have taken over my body, and my real self is in a cocoon in the cottage.
Almost believable. Except everyone saw Hurst with Harry today.
I looked down into my glass. I lied to get the job here. I faked a reference from my old school. I did not leave under a halo so much as under a cloud. Harry found out.
Okay. What did you do at your old school that was so bad?
Nothing, actually. But I intended to steal money from the school safe to pay a debt. I watched her take this in.
But you didn't?
No. She nods, considering.
So, how did Harry find out?
Then she holds up a hand.
No, wait. Simon.
Didn't Simon mention he knew you from somewhere? Yeah. And I'm guessing Simon knows Hurst.
I didn't realize he did.
But then Simon is just the sort of bum bogey who would stick himself up anyone's arse to get a bit further up the ladder. Bum bogey? She raises her glass.
And that's being kind to him.
Well, obviously being a bum bogey works. Because here I am, currently and probably permanently, jobless.
I wouldn't be so sure. Harry likes you.
The kids seem to like you.
Harry knows he'll have a hell of a job filling that post.
I shake my head. Hurst won't let Harry take me back on.
You and Hurst aren't really ancient history, are you? What is it between you two?
I put my glass down and look at her across the table. In the dim light, she looks younger again. It softens the faint lines around her mouth and on her forehead. Her dark eyes seem very wide, and her skin very soft and pale.
I feel a tug.
I wanted one thing about this place to be good and honest. Just one thing. Beth frowns.
What are you staring at?
Have I got something on my face?
No.
I pause. Nothing. She continues to stare at me suspiciously. Then she says,
So you were about to tell me about you and Hurst?
Was I?
You were.
The truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth.
Something like that.
We fell out, badly, in our teens. Stupid, looking back. Over a girl, as these things usually are.
Was the girl Marie Gibson?
Yes. The lie comes easily. She sips her drink.
I wouldn't have had her down as your type.
Why? What do you think is my type?
I mean, she's pretty, but...
But what?
Don't take this the wrong way.
Okay.
I know this seems a shitty thing to say with the cancer and everything, but she's always seemed a bit of a bitch.
I'm slightly taken aback. Well, she could be tough when she wanted to be.
I don't mean tough. I mean a bitch. She would throw her weight around because of Hurst. I've seen her reduce a teacher to tears at a parents' evening. Once, she went around to another mother's house because their kid had accused Hurst Jr. of bullying. This woman worked part-time for the council. Next day, contract terminated.
A frown. I suppose Marie could be a bit of a firecracker. And a mother can't always see their offspring's faults. Still, it doesn't sound like the Marie I remember. Well, people change, I suppose.
Not that much.
And I was young and foolish back then.
What are you now?
Old and cynical.
Join the gang.
No, I think. She puts on a good front. But I don't believe that. I can see it in her eyes. The light hasn't gone out. Not completely. Not yet. That reminds me, I say. You never told me which one you are. Her forehead creases.
Which one of what?
Want to make a difference, or can't get a job anywhere else?
Well, obviously. Who wouldn't want this?
She spreads her arms. So you want to make a difference?
Is this an interview now?
No, I was just wondering.
About me?
About Emily Ryan. Her face changes. The softness is gone. She was the pupil you were talking about, wasn't she? The one who killed herself. You really know how to ruin a mood. You said she was a student of yours, but you weren't teaching her when she died.
Been doing your research?
Just call me Columbo.
I can think of other names. And I don't have to tell you anything.
True.
I barely know you.
True.
You're fucking irritating when you're agreeable.
Also, she holds up a hand.
Okay, you're right. Emily wasn't my student. A pause. She was my niece. My sister was a few years older than me. No dad around, and Mum wasn't exactly Mum of the Year. So we were close. We grew up in Edgeford. You know it?
I've heard of it. Not the best area of Nottingham.
Anyway, Carla, my sister, she got pregnant pretty young. Following the family tradition, the dad didn't hang around, but she was a brilliant mum. She brought Emily up while training to be a nurse. Emily was a sweet kid. She grew up into a pretty okay teenager.
That's a feat.
I was teaching at a school in Derby, so I couldn't come and see them that much. But Emily and I would text or FaceTime. She came to stay with me a few times. We'd go shopping, to the cinema and stuff. I was the cool auntie, I suppose.
Well, that's what cool aunties are for.
A tiny smile. Don't get me wrong. She was 13. She could be moody sometimes. But overall, she was good to be around. Bright, funny, inquisitive.
I feel my heart give a little. I wonder what sort of teenager Annie would have been. Loud, outgoing, funny, sporty. Or would she have reverted into herself, like so many do?
Then Carla got a job. A good job. They moved.
Emily had to change schools. Let me guess. They moved to Arnhill.
She nods. The job was at the hospital in Mansfield. Arnhill wasn't far, houses were cheap, and the school was within walking distance. It seemed to make sense.
Most bad decisions do at the time. Moving schools to any school is tough when you're 13, I say.
To start with, it seemed okay.
But?
It was too hunky-dory. You know, when everything is so friggin' fine, it just can't be.
What did your sister say?
She sighs. She didn't get it. I mean, don't get me wrong. She loved that girl's bones. But it was like she just didn't see the problem. Or she didn't want to.
I nod. We're all too busy. Too distracted by the sheer effort of getting through each day. Working. Paying the bills, the mortgage, the shopping. That we don't want to look deeper. We don't dare. We want things to be fine. To be hunky-dory. Because we simply haven't got the mental energy to deal with it if they're not. It's only when something bad happens, something irretrievable, that we see things properly. And then it's too late.
Did you try and talk to Emily? I tried. I even drove over to see her. Took her for pizza, like we used to. Except it wasn't the same.
How do you mean?
You done with those?
We both glance up. Lauren hovers over the table. Yes, thanks, I say. And could we get a couple more?
She nods. Suppose.
She wanders back to the bar.
Beth glances at me. She must really like you. She doesn't do table service for just anyone.
My natural charm. So, you were saying?
Her face darkens again. We went to her favourite pizza place, but she didn't eat much. She was just moody, sarcastic. It wasn't her.
kids can change in senior school, I say. It's like someone flicks a switch, the hormones crank up to 11 and all bets are off.
No shit. I'm a teacher too, remember?
I know what it's like. Invasion of the body snatchers. She picks up a beer mat and begins to peel it apart.
But even when Emily was going through a teenager phase before, she still talked to me. I thought our relationship was different.
Did she say anything about school? Stuff that was bothering her?
Nope. And when I asked, she just clammed up.
Lauren returns and plonks down two more bourbons. If they are doubles, then the optics are malfunctioning. Maybe Beth was right. Maybe she does like me. Beth takes a sip.
Now I think I should have pushed her. Made her talk to me.
That doesn't work like that. Push teenagers too hard and they'll just go scuttling back into their shells.
Yeah. But you know the shit thing. I didn't even hug her goodbye. We always hugged. But this time she just walked away. And I thought, cool auntie, I'll let her go. Give her time. Turns out we didn't have time. 2 weeks later, she was dead.
She sniffs, wipes angrily at her eyes.
I should have hugged her.
You couldn't have known. Because life never gives you a heads up.
Well,
I should have done. I'm a teacher. I should have realized this wasn't the usual moody teens. I should have spotted the signs of depression. She was my niece, and I let her down. Guilt washes over me in a wave. I feel crippled by it for a moment. I swallow. What happened to your sister? She shakes her head, gathering herself.
She couldn't stay. Not in that house, where it happened. She moved back to Edgeford, nearer to Mum. She's still having a hard time dealing. I go back as often as I can, but it's like Emily's death is this barrier between us and we can't seem to work our way around it.
I know what she means. Grief is personal. It isn't something you can share, like a box of chocolates. It's yours, and yours alone. A spiked steel ball chained to your ankle. A coat of nails around your shoulders. A crown of thorns. No one else can feel your pain. They cannot walk in your shoes because your shoes are full of broken glass, and every time you try and take a step forward, it rips your souls to bloody shreds. Grief is the worst kind of torture, and it never ends. You have dibs on that dungeon for the rest of your life.
Is that why you came here? I ask.
Because of Emily.
When the job came up a couple of months later, it seemed like it was meant to be.
Funny how that happens. Why didn't you tell me at the start?
Because Harry doesn't know. I didn't want him to think I was here for the wrong reasons.
Like?
Revenge.
And you're not?
At the start, maybe. I wanted someone to be held accountable for Emily's death. She sighs. But I couldn't find anything. At least, not anything specific. Just the usual friendships and fallouts.
What about Hurst?
She never mentioned him.
But, I prompt.
Something isn't right at that school, and Hurst is a part of it. When you let a kid like Hurst get away with the stuff he does, you create a place where cruelty is the norm.
I wonder if that's all. I remember what Marcus said about Hurst taking kids up to the old colliery site. Kids who wanted to fit in. Perhaps even a young girl, desperate to be accepted in a new school. The pit could get to you in more ways than one, like it did with Chris.
You've gone quiet.
Just thinking that history has a shitty habit of repeating itself, I say bitterly.
But it shouldn't. The only way schools like Arnhill Academy change is from the inside. Teaching is not all about